Welcome to the Gear Garage Live Show. This weekly YouTube show covers whitewater rafting, river safety,
oh God, I lost my paddle,
gear, and anything else Zach feels like rambling on about.
Well, here we are again on a Tuesday for the Gear Garage Live Show. This is where I answer questions that have been submitted throughout the week and talk about things I want to talk about, which aren't many this week. I have a lot of stuff I want to talk about, but I don't want to bore you all with that. If you have questions, throw them in the comments. I'll get to them live. If you're listening to this as a podcast, awesome. Thank you. This is not meant to be a podcast. We've just turned it into a podcast because people asked us to. It's meant to be a live show, so hopefully you get something out of it. And the first thing I want to do today is talk about our sponsor, GoRafting.com. I haven't talked about them for a while because their stuff hasn't been as important over the winter. Like, we don't all need river maps in the winter. But permits are coming out soon. I don't know, maybe in a day or two. And a lot of you will get your permits and you'll need a map. And I'm just going to advocate. I use GoRafting.com. They sponsor the show. I get a few bucks from them. Thank you guys for sponsoring, helping support some of the stuff we do. But I actually used this map. I used it on the Grand Canyon. I loved it. I don't usually need river maps for the rivers I do because I've done them so many times. But if I'm going to go do a new river and I have a map, this is where I'll go to get it. Because not only does it tell you where things are, it tells you where you're at. And I know there's another map out there. I forget what it's called. I think Waterways or something like that. They're maps and they show you where you are on the map and they show you where stuff is. But the cool thing about these ones is they know the river distance and they know how many miles you are from something. It's not just like, here's the map, here's my location. It's like, it knows you're at mile 22.1 and at 22.5, there's a cool camp on river left. They'll say, you know, you can either look at a map mode or like linear mode where it tells you how far is the next thing. It's super cool. We used it on the Grand Canyon when we were looking for a camp and I downloaded the whole map to my phone, including photos. And I was looking through photos of one particular camp. And I'm like, let's go there. That place looks cool. And it turns out it was cool. It was a great camp. And so they have a bundle, which I don't know. I think they're losing money. I'm not even just saying this. It sounds like I'm saying this, but these maps, you know, it's like 10 bucks for the Food Lofu, which I don't think I would ever need because it's weird to have a map of a run that's like 12 miles. Let's see how far the Food Lofu is. It's like 12 miles. Let's see what they say it is. They also have for free on their website, once you go through a lot of this stuff, a mile-by-mile guide usually for free. See, it's all the way down here. So it's, if you start at the border, which I don't know if most people do, but the whole thing here, we're looking at 11.25 kilometers, which is, wait, is that the whole thing? Does that include, where are we at here? Does that include bridge to bridge? Hard to say. See, there's, oh, here we go. Inferno Canyon, put it, got it. That starts at kilometer 13, it looks like. I don't know. It's not that many kilometers. Let's see. We're looking at, oh, here we go. No, it's a few, all the way down to the, I don't know. I have to look at how many kilometers is. This is separate, but it's not a river I would use a map for, but there's a lot of other rivers you'd use a map for, like the Grand Canyon, the Middle Fork of the Sandman, the Rogue, the Illinois. The Illinois map I helped them with. I'm very proud of that map. I did a pretty good job on it. Anyway, you can buy a whole bundle of them. Let's see if they still do it. Save 85% with the Whitewater Classics bundle. For $60, you get all the maps, basically all the important ones. It's a killer deal. I'm shocked they make it so affordable. And if you have your phone on the river, it just makes sense to get this app. The guys that go rafting, the Far Out is a real app. So Far Out is an app that is a real developer. They do hiking maps, all kinds of stuff. The Go Rafting guys just do the rafting map for Far Out. So you download the Far Out app, you purchase the maps from Go Rafting somehow through the app, and you get access to them. And like I said, they're sweet. Like, I really think it's useful. For $60, when a paper map costs like at least 20, for $60 to have all the maps, or all the most of the maps, is a killer deal. So again, while you're all thinking about your permits and the permits you get, you may want to look into GoRafting.com, and they're a sponsor. Okay, let's move on to the show. Next step is answering questions. I see Sean has some comment already. I like my nice two-man IK, 500-pound Whalemen, not bad for multi-day, especially late. Oh, cool. Yes, we had never used one. It's good to get some feedback on those nice kayaks because we have talked about them a little bit. For those of you that don't know, there's a company, Nice, N-Y-C-E, that makes kayaks. They look cool. They look like a less expensive version of like the Sotar ATV, which I'm not sure if they make anymore, or the Wing Jimbo for doing like, you know, for doing ducking or kayaking, for inflatable kayaking for bigger people like me, or overnight trip where you need to put gear in the boat. So let's get to our questions. The first one is about book recommendations. Hey, Zach, I've heard you mention a few books in past Gear Garage episodes, but I can't remember specific titles. Do you have any recommendations for books on outdoor leadership, guiding, recreation management, or coaching? Basically, anything to help someone grow in the outdoor industry, or is just an overall good read? I recently became an outfitter and I'm trying to build my knowledge base and expand my river library. So I'd love to know which books you consider must reads for professionals, private ship leaders. I have conflicted thoughts about this as I read this. I feel like you can learn some things from books, but a lot of outdoor, what people call outdoor leadership, is just going outdoors and being a leader and making mistakes and learning from mistakes and being modest and self-introspective. So I feel like there's a lot of good books about stuff, but I just want to inform, like share my thoughts. Like outdoor leadership and leadership are the same thing. I don't know what the difference is. Like you can learn about leadership. You can go outdoors. And if you're doing leadership outdoors, you're doing outdoor leadership. But I don't think you have to read outdoor leadership to be a good leader. I would almost prefer reading really good books about leadership. And some of my favorite books, like Tom Peters writes a lot of great stuff about leadership. Simon Sinek has a lot of videos and books about leadership. And so I would focus personally on, there's a book called, it's written by a Navy captain who took the worst part of the Navy to the, It's Your Ship. It's a great leadership book. I would say the best outdoor leadership book I know of is titled It's Your Ship. Or another one, good one, because it's an amazing leadership book in general that applies to everything. Or another one is 10 Rings by Phil Jackson. And Phil Jackson, for those of you that don't know, was the coach of the Bulls when they won 6 championships, and then the Lakers when they won, I think, 3 with him as coach. And he won 1 as a player. He's, you know, he amazing thoughts about leadership. If you like basketball at all, it's a great read. Even if you don't like basketball, it's an amazing book. I'd highly recommend. So if you're asking about like leadership, outdoor leadership, I would just read about leadership. I don't know the difference between leadership and outdoor leadership. For guiding, I'd say the classic is Bill McGinnis's The Guide's Guide. Do I have a copy here? No, I don't have a copy here. I think that's just like a classic treatise on guiding. It's worth a read. Recreation management. I don't know if I have any particulars. The one I'm in the middle of now, though, is about risk management. I think recreation management is just management. Like whether it's recreation management or managing a KFC, I mean, it's all management. But what makes managing recreation different, the big thing is we have a risky sport. And so I would say things unique to the outdoor industry would be about risk management. And I'm reading a book right now called Beneficial Risks. Let me go back to the internet, that I'd highly recommend in terms of risk management, because it takes a modern take on, it's called Beneficial Risks. Let me see if I can find it. Is this it? It's $72, by the way. It's not cheap, but it shouldn't be cheap. He worked hard on it. He's not selling that many copies. He's got to sell it for a lot. And I think what we do in our industry with risk management is we just say, don't do that. Don't do that. Like we manage risk by not allowing risk. And the premise of this book is that taking risks is beneficial to us as human beings. I mean, if you don't want to take risk, you should just stay home in a patented room. But there are benefits. The premise of the book is that there's benefits to taking risk, and that we need to take risks. And we just need to be smart about it and apply some nice strategies to preventing bad outcomes from taking risk. So I can't speak enough to how much I like this book, and I think it sets a good tone. So I would say in terms of like outdoor leadership, or like, and people, outdoor leadership is just like a overall term for like people being outdoorsy, I think. But for like managing outdoor sports and people, this book is top of my list. If you specifically want an outdoor type book, it's really like another one. It's really good about coaching. It's called I think it's called Coaching Adventure Sports. I think this is written in Europe. And so I would say this one's more about, is this the right one? Coaching event. I think this one, oh man, internet, continue shopping. Let me see if I can pull it up. Let's see if this one comes up. This one right here. This book is great. This one is, I would say, more about teaching others to do adventure sports. And again, it's a very modern take. It's a really smart take. And one of my favorite parts about this, I've done videos on this channel that reference this book, and it talks about, there's a, and I have to remember, I do videos about the stuff because I forget, but it's like a hierarchy of instruction and guiding. And, you know, guiding, when you guide someone, you're taking someone with no skills and you're kind of doing stuff for them. You know, you're taking, like when I guide trips, I'm like cooking them food, I'm rowing the boat, I'm telling them about the place. They're involved a little bit, like they set their own tent and they don't have to, but they usually do. But they're on vacation, I'm guiding them. That's like a low level of instruction. And then there's a person who is an instructor, and that person tells people things. And isn't that invested in their outcomes? They're just invested in sharing their information. A great example of this, I would say, of what I would call an instructor, are rescue instructors. The rescue instructors are there to teach a topic they know about. I don't think most of them are actually that invested in their outcomes. I was talking to a rescue instructor a few months ago, because I'm on a side tangent now, but I was talking to an instructor because one of his students was teaching one of my classes and was teaching something that was wrong, like 100% wrong. And after he taught the thing, I pulled him aside and said, "Hey, just so you know, that's wrong." And no, I learned that in the class. And I found out I need to know who your instructor is. I do this all the time when I'm working with graduates of rescue classes. They tell me something with confidence that is just wrong, not even gray area, just wrong. And I say, "Okay, well, tell me who your instructor was." And I try to track the instructor down, try to figure out what happened. In this case, the student heard the wrong thing. And the instructor was like, "That, you know, he just didn't, I gave him the right information. He just didn't absorb it correctly. I mean, that's just what happens." And it was like, "Hey, that's life." And I think that's what instructors do. They share information. They're not that invested in, and it's important that we have instructors that are teaching things, but they aren't that instructed in that. They're not that invested in keeping the information or making sure that the information sinks in and is applied and they're in moving on. And again, I see this all the time in rescue specifically. People take a class, you think they should know things, and they leave that class not having correct information, whether they were taught the wrong thing or their understanding was incorrect. So this book calls that, I think it calls it instruction. There's guiding where you do everything, instruction where you teach them things. And then there's coaching. There's one more layer in there, I forget what it is, but let's just say there's three for now. There's a fourth. The highest level is coaching. It's where you are instructing people. You're checking for their understanding. You're giving them areas to practice and improve. And you as a, whatever you, if you want to call yourself a coach, an instructor, whatever you are, guide, whatever you want to call yourself. But if you're acting as a coach, you're invested in their success. And the best instructors I know are that way. They're invested in everybody's success. They want to see everybody do well. And they teach by repetition. They check in on people. I can think of my friend Mark Hurst, who I've learned a ton from, and he's probably my coach. And Mark comes out and we teach together in every spring. And I noticed that Mark is checking in with the students a lot. He doesn't have to. Like, he's got other things to do, but I notice he really cares about the success of students. And when I catch up with him in the winter, he's like, he asked me, how's so-and-so doing? How's so-and-so doing? What's so-and-so doing? Did so-and-so ever get better at this? Like, Mark is a classic example of an instructor or a coach who is personally invested in the people he teaches. I have the most respect for that. And I think this book, one of the biggest points I've gotten from this book is that. There's a big difference between guiding, instructing, and coaching. And the coaching is like the highest level. Oh, yeah, after coaching is mentoring. And I actually consider what Mark doing is mentoring. And that's where you like take somebody on for a long time. Yeah, so it goes guiding, instructing, coaching, mentoring is like the highest level. But mentoring takes a lot of work. Anyway, big side tangents. I would say this is one of my favorite books about adventure sports in general. And I would say learning how to share information. And it's really important to me as a business owner, as an outfitter, because I have to run a business, but I also, it's my job to make sure our guides are growing and getting better and learning things. And I can teach them that in a lecture format, or I can see my value as a coach who's continually providing the value and checking in on them all the time. So that's a lot. Those are my books. Great question. So to get back to, and I should write a blog about this so I can link to all these books. To just sum this up, in terms of leadership, I'm a big fan of Tom Peters, his books on leadership and marketing. And Tom Peters is great. 10 Rings by Phil Jackson. What's the other one? The other leadership book I really liked. There's one more that I mentioned before. In terms of guiding, Bill McGinnis's book about guiding is like the go-to book. Recreation management, I would just read management books, but I would focus on and risk management books, specifically that one I mentioned earlier, Beneficial Risks. And then coaching, this book, Coaching Adventure Sports, is just a classic. And these books are expensive because, go back to this, I bet this is like $70 too for this book, because it's a very small audience. It's a lot of work to write and also publish, probably self-publish the book. Let's see where it's for sale. Book. Let's see. You can buy your copy here. Let's just find out how much it costs. It probably costs a lot. And it should cost a lot. Doesn't see how much it costs. Here we go. Shop now. $30, but those aren't dollars. Those are like European dollars. So not that much, actually, for what it is. Another book, while we're on the topic of books, though, well, and I'm going to move on with questions here in a second. Oh, yeah. This is Your Ship. Is that what it's called? I thought it's called It's Your Ship. Let's go look at this. Let me go back. This is a book about leadership. I'm pretty sure it's Your Ship. Yeah, it's called It's Your Ship, this book. This one, it's not open right now. Go back to here. This is the book I would say is one of my favorite. I don't think I enjoy reading leadership books that much always, but one of the ones that has had the biggest influence on me personally. And, you know, the gist of it is that, you know, in the military, there's officers and enlisted. Officers eat separately than enlisted. Those of you who are in the military, you probably don't get this, but there's like two classes of people in the military. It's crazy. Officers generally went to college and took some officer schools, enlisted, did some sort of basic training. I was enlisted when I was in the Army. I knew that side of things. And this guy was an officer in charge of the ship, and he didn't get the ship he wanted, if I remember right. He got put on the worst ship. And he's like, oh, great, I'm on the worst ship. And he basically valued the enlisted people and listened to them, which is not a normal thing in the military. Like, you're officers. There's an assumption the officers know more. And he listened to them and took feedback from them and listened to people on the ground and applied what they thought needed to get done to how the ship was run, took the worst ship in the Navy to the best ship in the Navy. It's an amazing story and a great book about leadership. That's the one I'm thinking of. But while we're on the topic of books, let's go back to, where are we at? Back here. There's my friend Peter Fox also just, and I should have his book with me to share with you all right now. He just wrote a book, and I wonder if I can find it. I can't remember the title of it. Using the Water. I don't even know if I can find it here in Google. Use the Water, Peter, oh gosh, Rafting Books. If anybody knows the name of this right now, I'm embarrassed I forgot. of Peter Fox rowing. Let the water do the work. And this just came out this last week, and he has 1 5-star review. So it, you know, obviously somebody likes it. But it's just, he's self-published. This book came out, like I said, just last week. Peter Fox is a legendary boatman. He was on the first raft ascent of the Fugloofugu, first raft ascent of the Stikine, a bunch more things. He taught our rowing schools for like 10 years and helped me develop our whole rowing school program. I mean, his fingerprints are all over how we teach rowing. Really amazing dude. And this book is probably, I skimmed an early copy of it, and it's a great like story. Kind of reminds me a little bit of that book Kevin Federico wrote, the Emerald Mile, where it's the Emerald Mile about the Grand Canyon enveloped in a story about a speed run down the Grand Canyon. Peter's book is a book about learning to row enveloped around a bunch of stories about expeditions, early expeditions. So it's part history, part, I think, technique, and definitely like another book worth checking out. I got to read it, and I'll talk more about this in future shows. Okay, so hopefully that answers that question. I have a massive library of river books. Like, I have just out in my main office over there. I mean, I could go on and on and on about, you know, river description books, river rescue books, river safety books, a zillion. I'm a huge fan of having a big library of books to look at, like my old woofer class books, my old rescue class books, new rescue books, modern ones, first aid books, tons of them. So I'm a big fan of having a library. Good, great question. Great question. I'm moving on. Sotar ATV versus Wing Jimbo. Oh, wow. We were just talking about this. I've been enjoying your inflatable kayak content. Had a quick question. I noticed you've moved away from the Sotar ATV and now seem to favor the Wing Jimbo. Could you share what drove that change and how you compare the two in terms of handling, stability, durability, and overall feel on the river? So the ATV was something I designed 15 years ago. And the idea came from doing the Chetco, and one of my friends had a pack raft. And he did fine, but it was a bit of a struggle. I remember watching him in the pack raft and thinking, man, if that thing was only longer, it would do much better. And if it only had an inflatable floor instead of just hitting his butt all the time. So I got back from that. I was inspired to build the ultimate boat for the Chetco. And that's the Sotar ATV. Long, big tubes, big bulbous bow. So when you go over a drop, it just eats up the drop, no problem. But also volume in the bow and the stern of the kayak. So if you put gear in the bow and the stern, it doesn't just sink. You need, if you're going to carry gear, you need to have big tubes all around. And so that's what the Sotar ATV was for. We used those on our Chetco trips for a while, but they're like 35, 40 pounds each. And when I had it, I met the people from Wing somehow. And I was talking about this, how I really need a lighter boat because every ounce really adds up on the Chetco. If I can drop weight carrying stuff into, it's a 10-mile hike, right, with all this gear. And if you just start with a 35-pound boat, it might be more than that, but you have a boat, PFD, helmet, paddle, safety gear, and then you have the normal stuff you would take backpacking, food, stove, clothes. Your packs get to be like 70, 80 pounds really quick, which is unsafe. So the people at Wing had this fabric that they were using for some military application. And I told them the story about how I love a lighter IK. Like, I think we can apply this lighter fabric to that design. And they did. And I bought like 6 of them. And we still have them. We still use them on the Chetco. They're great. They're not as durable as the ATV, but for the weight, hands down, like, they're the boat. So, and I think Sotar kind of got away from the ATV. I don't think, I mean, they probably would make more of them. They probably have the design. And I should ask Jeremiah about that. But the only design change I made on the Jimbo is that I gave it a little bit less rocker. I just toned the rocker down a little bit, which I'm not sure matters that much. Wait, or did I give it more rocker? I changed the rocker profile. Now I can't remember what I did. I think I gave it less rocker. I'm pretty sure that's what I did. And I wish we'd put a thicker floor on it because you're always sitting in water. And there's a few of the things I would tweak now if I could. Like the seat's a little weird, but but the cool thing is we put D-rings in better places and we're more thoughtful about the D-ring placement for rigging gear in. And a lot of our ATVs, the D-rings broke off. You could pull them off by hand almost because they weren't very well made back then. So the reason I moved from Sotar ATV to the Jimbo is because they're lighter. That's the only reason. They're both the same design, I think. So they handle the same boat. Stability is the same. Durability, I would say that because the Jimbo is made of thinner material, it's a tiny bit less durable, but they can make the Jimbo out of thick material. They can make Jimbo out of the most durable material on earth. They can make it and they can coat it, but it's just going to be heavy and expensive. But the feel in the river, they're the same. I would say like the thinner material gives a little bit more flex in the boat, which I don't like. But again, to save whatever we save, I think the Jimbos are 19 pounds. To save 16 pounds a boat, worth it. That, without even a question. If I'm going to go drag to put in, I don't care. I'd probably prefer the ATV or the wing Jimbo with more stiff, thicker material. I definitely would prefer the better material. But for hiking in, hands down, the thinner stuff. I'm currently deciding between these both for similar use, and your insight will be helpful. Well, if your use is hiking stuff in, it's the Jimbo. If your use is going boating and overnight trips, and that's it, ATV. Or the Jimbo with the thicker material, like I said. Currently, the Jimbo is more than double the price of ATV, and Sotar is still willing to mail it. So that's cool. I'm sure Sotar is willing to make it. They just don't have the – they just aren't actively producing them. Wing stuff got very expensive. I don't know what happened, but wing stuff is now off the charts expensive. So I'm not sure – I don't know who's going to buy their stuff. And maybe it's their way of doing whitewater stuff, right? Like they're going to sell whitewater stuff, but not that much of it. Maybe they don't need the work or want the work. Or maybe it's just how much it costs for them to make it now. Maybe, you know, labor's gone up and the cost of materials has gone up and it's just what it costs. But the wing rafts, I think, are like 10,000 minimum. For like, you know, I think boats I bought from Wing for 8,000 are probably like 14,000 now. They've raised their prices so much. And I don't know the numbers exactly. Call Wing to verify. Like that's just what I've heard. That's just me sharing things in my brain that I've heard that may or may not be true. But I mean, if it's twice the price, just get the ATV. Unless you're hiking in and you want that thinner material, man, 16 pounds is a lot of pounds when you're hiking 10 miles on rough trails. Okay, cool. Great question. Moving on. Next question is, okay, this is a long one. Hi, Zach. My raft had an unfortunate encounter with Killer Fang Falls at mile 232 in the Grand Canyon last September. There are two types of rafters, those who have rafted and those who haven't yet. Well, I seem to have been promoted to the first group now. The rafter was able to limp out to Pierce Ferry, though none of them tore loose. The four D-rings are pretty shredded. The raft is a PVC Vanguard, and I haven't been able to get a reply from that company. I could add new D-rings below the damaged originals, but I'm worried the placement will be off. Do you know where I could find out how to remove and replace D-rings or have it done by a professional? I'm in Reno and hope to find a place that isn't too far a drive. Do you have any advice for me other than taking up knitting like other old ladies like me? I mean, the Vanguard's PVC, so it's fairly easy to fix. I wouldn't stress too much about just adding the D-rings below or near the originals. I mean, their original placement probably wasn't right either. Like, you know, the raft manufacturers, they're just guessing where to put D-rings. They're usually way off. And so if you just put one next to it, and just think about where you would want D-rings and then put them there. If you just have D-rings for rafts, it doesn't, like, having it below next to doesn't matter that much. But in order to get the old glue off and to prep that surface. PVC, like I said, it's fairly easy to repair. I just get a Dremel tool with a little like spinny sandpaper thing and go over the whole thing, or just get sandpaper and just sandpaper off the old glue. If it's a lot of glue, you have to use chemicals. I think I'm just doing this off memory. I think for PVC boats and PVC glue, you want to use MEK, which is a very nasty substance. Like, you don't want to breathe it. You don't want to touch it. I don't like to even be around it. I probably have some in a bottle right here that I'm scared to be. I should probably throw it away. Do I have a bottle here? Yeah, I have a
a bottle in a bag.
Like, I don't even like being around it. Honestly, I should get rid of it. But you can't just throw it away. It's a dangerous chemical. You have to wait till, you know, like, whatever, the once a month hazardous removal day. Hazardous, whatever that is. So you can get MEK, toluene might work, some just nasty chemical. You can rub it, you can sandpaper it, and then you can just get whatever the two-part glue is for PVC. I forget what it is. I mean, honestly, if I'm a – we're going to get to your question about should I hire somebody professionally in a second. I don't do that much repair personally anymore. I used to do a ton because I'm kind of tired of dealing with the chemicals. I think it's really bad for me. And the professionals do a better job. It's just you got to take the boats to them, which is what we're going to get to. But I would literally just go to PVC repair tips, Vanguard. This is exactly how I would do my research, which there's some, a bunch of videos, how to PVC and urethane boat repair. And I'm now like using AI all the time. If you go to the AI mode in Google, it's just like, boom, two-part Clifton PVC adhesive, get that. The solvents MEK, like I said, I would double check my memory here. Past material, clean thoroughly, use MEK. Yeah, abrasion, use some sandpaper, just like I said. Just 2 to 3 coats. It's, you know, you can, it's not that hard. I don't like putting D-rings on because it's not, D-rings are not just like one flat patch. It's actually like the back is always like some of the sewing and stuff is back there. So you got to be really careful with the glue. But you certainly can remove the old glue with MEK and then patch in the same spot or patch it next to it. Doesn't matter. But your other question, which I think is a really interesting one, is, you know, I'm in Reno and hope to find a place that isn't too far to drive. I don't know anywhere near Reno that does repair. And maybe somebody watching here knows. That's the beauty of the show, is like there's people listening that probably know the answer. Lots of comments, Sean. A Pacific River Supply in Rodeo, California repairs rafts, the Bay Area. Okay, so Sean knows. So I think Sean's in Sacramento. And so, I mean, that's a bit of a drive. Yeah, finding people to do repairs is a pain. I have a boat in my back shed that I need to get repaired. I just haven't taken time to take it to somebody. I don't want to do it. It's actually an annoying decky repair that I don't want to deal with. If it was just a patch, we'd probably just do it here. Jared says, I think you can also use rubbing alcohol on PVC and stay bond for glue. Yeah, I mean, it's worth trying rubbing alcohol. It's just dealing with MEK. When I use MEK or any, if I do any boat repair, even dealing with the glue, I'm wearing a respirator mask and like heavy duty gloves. And I've done in my lifetime a lot of repairs without gloves and no respirator. And I just wonder how much of this toxic chemicals are breathed in. And so, but now I'm just like, I've suit up. It's a whole bunch of stuff I wear, but that is probably, I mean, this AI answer is pretty good. Yeah. And honestly, yeah. So I would do that. And you can even ask it, say, what if it's a D-ring? The AI is like, so it's basically replaced me. I don't even know why you guys ask me questions, because here we go. D-ring. It just says exactly what to do for the D-ring. It's not, AI is not perfect yet, but it's really good. Remove the old glue. Here we go. Carefully remove any old glue residue from both the raft surface and the D-ring patch using a razor knife. Ooh, I'm not sure I would do that. Yeah, so that's probably wrong. I would use MEK and sandpaper. But it's actually pretty good. Oh, here we go. How to install D-rings. NRS has an article about it. Boom. Here we go. Let's bring. Oh, you don't see what I'm seeing. Let me get back to this. So this is what I always forget that I have to open the windows. This is what AI said when I just asked it on a detached D-ring. It said here to use a knife to remove the old glue, which might work, but I wouldn't recommend it. But also, it mentions this video. I mean, NRS has a video right here, how to install D-rings and hookups, which is, they're probably recommend, this is probably Hypalon. The Hypalon and PVC aren't that far off. Oh, here we go. It says here, clean the boat and patch with solvent to remove any contaminants. Use toluene or use toluene for hypalon and methyl ethyl ketone for PVC and urethane. Yeah, so use NDK, that'll get it off. So hopefully that answers your question. Sean saying can't get MEK in, can't. Oh yeah, I have heard MEK should be illegal, honestly. Like, and I have a bunch of it somewhere I don't want to have. It's nasty stuff. I'm glad I don't sell it anymore, honestly. I heard it's hard to get toluene too. And one more comment here. Wing uses thicker material on Jimbo now, a little heavier, but way too expensive. Yeah, you could probably get one with my thinner material if you ask them. I don't know for sure, but they probably could make some potentially. But they should use a thicker material because most people that are buying deckies aren't buying them to hike them in 10 miles. Hiking them in 2 or 3 miles, 40 pounds is fine. 10 miles with overnight gear, you want the lightest thing you can get. All right, so I think that's the last question, the last comment. Let's see where we're at. Let's go back to here at the stage. No more questions. That's it. While I have you all on the show or the podcast, I'm going to promote one more thing, if you all don't mind. And then the show's over. Unless somebody throws a question in the chat thing here in a second. We have our Class 3 safety and rescue classes, which are basically rescue classes with a lot of prevention designed for private boaters. This class, I'm super stoked on. I think they're sold out. I think we're full. We might add one more of these. We have 2 spots open April 24th. But this class is specifically designed, it's curriculum built for private boaters about how to prevent accidents and also what to do, like developing skills to be better at doing rescues when you're in the field. I'm super jazzed on this. But the class where we don't have a lot of signups, where I'm excited about this almost more, are these one-day safety and rescue clinics. And the idea is you don't want to do 3 days of a rescue class, or you have done a rescue class, but you want to improve your abilities at a particular item. So it's like a la carte rescue. So one-day thing, not a big commitment. It's just a day. You know, if you don't like the people in the class, you're only with them for a day. You're not stuck with them for 3 days. Right. And so we're doing these this spring and as a test. And I have 3 of them. There's openings on all of them. The first one, March 7th, is about mechanical advantage and throw bags. We'll do setups in 3-to-1s, maybe some even higher mechanical advantage if we're feeling cocky. And then practice with throw bags and modern techniques. On the 14th, we'll do entrapments, like body entrapments and raft pins. And then we'll do swimming and rescue harnesses on the 31st. If these are popular, we'll do more of them. I really am excited about this because I think most people are interested in learning a specific skill set, right? Not taking a whole class. And you can probably tell from earlier some of my conversation is like, I'm semi-frustrated with rescue classes right now. And that's why we're starting to offer more and more of them, because again, I hear what people learned when they're done and I'm a little disappointed, to be honest with you. And so we're trying to figure out how to provide education that is based on what is correct, because there are, like, and some people can say, well, how do you know the information is wrong? What makes you able to say it's right or wrong? It's just wrong. I don't need to go into it right now. There are things that are definitely being taught that are wrong, and people are leaving maybe hearing the right thing, but thinking the wrong thing. They didn't take the information incorrectly based on whatever scenario was set up. But also, there's things where I think there's a lot of disagreement within the rescue community. So some instructors teach one thing, some teach a different thing. There's not a consensus on a lot of topics. For example, mechanical advantage for taking undoing wraps. There's a lot of instructors teaching to do the transport hitch and vector pulls. I think that's insane. And they don't even teach 3-to-1 because they think it's dangerous. But most people, I would say 80%, are teaching 3-to-1. And so depending, you may take a class wanting to learn 3-to-1 because that's what everybody knows and uses and it's actually effective. And the instructor might teach you the transport hitch, which you will never remember. I almost guarantee you can be taught it, you can practice it 10 times. A year from now, you will not remember. It is so hard to remember the transport hitch. And so the idea with this is like, hey, you want a specific, like a specific topic taught by us. And I feel like what we're teaching like is a mix of all the curriculum the best we can. And we feel like we're teaching it correctly. Now we're not perfect. So we might teach stuff wrong. I have to admit, I'm not saying that like other instructors are bad and we're the best, but we're teaching what I think is the right curriculum, the right way, based on the bazillions of phone calls I have about this and conversations I've had. I've spoken on the phone and Facebook message today with two rescue instructors about rescue instruction. Like that's it's, and I actually had to a third person, my friend Aaron, who used to be on the show. We talked for quite a while today because he wants to start teaching rescue about rescue. So I've had three conversations today alone about rescue courses and philosophy. That's how much time I spend on this. So anyway, that's a long way of saying like I really care about getting information out there about safety and rescue. And the ways to do it are like 3-day classes, 1-day classes like this, or videos. Like the reason I do a lot of my Gear Garage videos, and the latest video I did was about some rescue stuff, is a way to get information out there based on my thinking and philosophy. Okay, I'm done rambling on. Thank you all for paying attention to another show. Sean says, good luck on all permits. Yep, good luck to everybody too. And my username blows. Thanks for doing these, always interesting. Is Tate planning on doing any more podcasts? I don't know, that's a good question. I know Tate's having fun skiing in Japan this week. So she's not here. You know, Tate has been just super busy. And so that's a great question. I'll have to ask her. It's good to know somebody's interested in her podcast. So she was doing it for me for fun. And then she's been kayaking a ton and working a ton. But next time I see her, I'll ask her. So that's it. Thanks everybody for watching. See you next week.